listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community solar-powered radio, live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa, and online at KRUUFM.com, streaming live all around the world. And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with me, it was my almost mic-less co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. And good morning if you're listening on Monday morning. We hope that the sun is shining Monday morning like it is Friday afternoon.
Oh, what a beautiful day we're having. It seems like spring finally decided to make an appearance. We have now three nice days in a row.
Yes, windy but very
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, yeah. And the flowers are blooming. There's red tulips out the window. The daffodils are starting to fade, but the magnolia trees are...
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, my red bud isn't really doing anything yet.
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
So it'll happen.
Yeah. First the magnolia trees, then the red buds, then that tree in your front yard.
Oh, yeah, the crab apple.
Yeah.
Oh, now, unfortunately, I understand that in a few days, it's supposed to drop below freezing again. Not good. Not good. Well, we are back talking with one of our most interesting writer today.
Oh, my goodness, yes. This is Kevin Smokler, and he's the author of the forthcoming essay collection, Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School.
Which I think is actually out in print now.
Okay.
Okay. And tell us a little more about Kevin here.
Okay. He's called a publishing visionary by the Huffington Post. His writing on the arts and technology has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Fast Company, and on NPR. He's the editor of the anthology Bookmark Now, writing in Unreaderly Times, which was a San Francisco Chronicle notable book of 2005. So he's been around.
All right. Well, welcome to Writers' Voices, Kevin.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with both of you.
Now, it seems like you really specialize in writing about books and writing. Is that true?
Yeah, that's kind of where my career has taken me thus far. It's definitely one of my great loves. I'm interested in a lot of things and hope to live long enough and write long enough to address them all. But where I've kind of begun is definitely writing about books.
And were you an avid reader when you were a child?
Yes, from a very early age. I grew up in a house full of books. My parents were both avid readers, but I like to say my parents were kind of avid everythingers. They had tons of books and tons of records, and they, you know, had subscriptions to 8 or 10 art series, and we were always going to museums and film festivals when we were kids.
Oh, wonderful. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay.
I'm also a Midwesterner, so I was really happy to see that you guys are from my part of the world as well.
That's true. And also, I note that your graduate degree is from the UT in Austin, which is my second home.
Oh, no kidding. Yes. Part of the reason I ended up in Austin was when I was looking for graduate schools, I said, find me a place like Ann Arbor that isn't Ann Arbor. And so
that isn't Ann Arbor, so because you didn't want to be that cold?
Yes.
Exactly. I got you.
A bit of a change of scene in the mid-90s when I was in graduate school, or the late 90s, was a really interesting time to be in Austin.
Oh, yeah. Now, I ended up in Austin because my daughter, when she graduated from high school in 1999, was looking at colleges. She wanted to go somewhere that wasn't as cold as Iowa. Mm. And my brother is in Houston, and I spend a lot of time on business down there with his company. And so, you know, UT was one of the schools that she looked at. And luckily for her, they gave her they allowed her in-state tuition, gave her a good scholarship. So it was no more expensive than going to the University of Iowa would have been for her.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yes.
So.
Also, at the early aughts, a really exciting time to be in Austin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then my son moved down there, too, and now I've got grandkids there. And so it's still a great time to be in Austin.
Yeah. I mean, it's a happen place.
Yeah. So now, did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
No. I had several flirtations with different careers. I've always written, and my first published piece that I ever got paid for was as a 15-year-old. newspaper intern in 1988, so I've been writing professionally for 25 years, but I've also worked in museums and with startup companies and flirted with academia and working in the law. I kind of ended up here after a long time being lost in the desert here in my late 30s.
And are you now full-time writing?
Yes, I am.
Wow, and you're making a living?
I am cobbling together a living.
It's not easy, is
which
it?
Which is basically the story of anybody who didn't, you know, who didn't start, anyone here in San Francisco who didn't start working at Apple 25 years
ago. Ah, yeah, yeah. So what drew you to write this particular book?
I had been poking around with a couple of these kinds of books that had really been very popular in the 50s and 60s in the United States. 50 books to read before you die, you know, the books that every smart, you know, upwardly mobile person needs to own, and I kind of wanted to do one of those for the 21st century. And my agent very smartly said, "Kevin, nobody cares what you think about great books," and she happened to be right. But she said, "Is there a way you can do that same project and frame it differently so it's not here's some books Kevin thinks are really interesting?" And together we both kind of came up with, "Well, how about the idea of rereading something that you probably came in contact with in high school long after you've exited high school." So that's pretty much where the premise came from, and also the idea that I was turning 40 and not a spring chicken anymore, and really was looking for a kind of reading experience that wasn't just about what is the newest, flashiest thing, one that gave me kind of context and perspective on my own life.
Now, how did you go about deciding what 50 books to include?
The very first thing I did was call all of my old high school teachers and say, "Remember me from back then? What did we discuss in class when I was here?" So that was the baseline group of books.
And they remembered?
They did. They did. They all remembered. Which
and they didn't
great,
say.
I
and
certainly didn't.
They didn't say, "Why didn't you pay attention?" And then you would know. They didn't say that. Huh?
I wouldn't have had to write this book had I actually paid attention. So I called all of them, and then I sort of made a list for myself of books that I thought, you know, I should know as a reasonably intelligent person, but didn't or hadn't come in contact with. And then I wanted to make sure that whatever list I included not only included books from when I graduated from high school, which was 1991, but also from my parents' generation and the generation that is more recently graduated from high school. Because I didn't want this book to be some time capsule of my time period, my time in high school.
Right.
And then finally, it was really important for me that this be a contemporary definition of a classic, meaning it not be all novels, it not be a parade of dead white men, and it be a 21st century version of what we consider literature.
And you even included some short stories.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I think classics come in all shapes and sizes, and I also felt like, emphasis on the word practical in the title, I also felt like it was really important that I not tell busy people with jobs and careers and hobbies and community commitments that of course you should read a 900-page Russian novel because I say so. I wanted people to be able to wade in instead of getting thrown involuntarily in the deep end.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you started working on this, did you read every single one of these books from cover to cover?
Yes, but there was a little bit of cheating. There was at least three cases, I believe: The Phantom Tollbooth, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, and one other. I don't remember which one, but definitely one other where I had read the book so many times. Oh, it was probably in The Band Played On, where I'd read the book so many times I actually didn't need to reread it. And that saved me some time. I only had 10 months to do this book, so that precluded anything that was too long.
Wow.
With a lot of the Russians, because I couldn't keep all their names straight. the names of their characters, that is.
Yes, I know what you mean.
and it also meant that I had to include some short stories and some essays, things I could ingest quickly and get to writing those particular chapters.
Was the 10-month a self-imposed deadline or an external?
Oh, a publisher-imposed deadline. Uh-huh.
So that makes it pretty important.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, it was a lot of work, and it was high pressure at times. But I think particularly for the first, my previous book was an anthology I had edited. This is the first book I've written all myself, and I think it was actually, you know, looking back, very helpful to have that deadline. It meant it was going to get done.
Oh, I bet. Do you have a favorite among these books?
There's kind of two answers to that question. There's the favorite that is actually my favorite book, and it's been my favorite book for a long time. The chapter on And the Band Played On by Randy Schultz is actually called my favorite book of them all. But I guess the other way to interpret that question is, what was my favorite book in the experience of rereading it? What was my favorite one to reread? And that was Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence, which I had spent some time with in high school and really didn't understand what a bunch of 19th century New York aristocrats had to say to a simple Midwestern Jewish boy like me, and therefore kind of dismissed it out of hand. And coming back to Miss Wharton as an adult, I still can't get over what a phenomenally gifted writer she was, and how much she makes the specifics of the world she grew up in universal to all of us. And so I really enjoyed reading The Age of Innocence, and I look forward to diving into more of her work.
Now, you describe yourself as a simple Midwestern Jewish boy. Is that possible?
Maybe. Maybe I'm exaggerating. When I was growing up in the mid '80s and being obsessed with the arts and popular culture like I was, the message I got that everything of consequence happened in New York and California, and we were kind of in the middle, you know, longing to be important like those places were. I know that's complete nonsense now, but I do remember thinking that I was. Even in a place like Ann Arbor, that I was a bit of a hayseed compared to the rest of them.
Yes, I know the feeling. I know what you mean.
You're listening to Writers' Voices.
I think that's an idea that's probably been dead for about 30 years.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Kevin Smokler, the author of Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Now, Kevin, you organized this book in a way that makes it, you know, maybe more accessible. Do you want to talk about how you came up with the plan, how you organized it? And
yes, of course. Yeah. So there are 50 essays in this book. It's divided into 10 sections, and each section corresponds with kind of an archetypal phase of life. So there are 5 essays on growing up, 5 on families, 5 on parents and children, 5 on growing older, 5 on work, 5 on falling in love, that sort of thing. I did that because it was very important for me that the argument I make for why to reread a great book was not because it's great, which to me is a little bit like saying, which is a little bit like prescribing sleep for exhaustion. You don't need to read a whole book to hear that. So instead, I wanted to say these books are not only great, but they're useful for certain times, for certain times of life. Which is why I make the argument that Fahrenheit 451 is perhaps a great book to have when you don't like your job very much, or The Age of Innocence is a great book to have when you're making large decisions in life, because Age of Innocence is about the inability to make important decisions. And of course, why I argue that To Kill a Mockingbird would make a great Father's Day gift, because it is a book with if nothing that displays great fatherhood at work. That was a big part of the organization. And then the style, I wanted to make sure that this was as accessible, as concise, as straightforward, as fun to read as it could be. As I've been touring, people have told me, have looked at me with rather guilty eyes and said, oh, well, I kind of skipped around. And you know, this book is next to the bathtub. Is that okay? I'm like, believe me, it sure is. If, in fact, the book has coffee and chocolate stains on it, so much the better, because the argument I'm making here is that classics, in addition to being great, are first and foremost supposed to be wildly enjoyable. And if you're having fun reading about me writing about books that are supposed to be fun, well, then my job is done here.
You know, I was really surprised. I guess I had never heard that... The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn was banned in high schools and so forth. I just never realized that. I wouldn't,
yes.
You know.
Yes, in fact, for different reasons over the history of that book. When it first came out, no less a literary giant than Louisa May Alcott actually called it a disgusting piece of filth that should never get in the hands of children.
I know. I
and she's one to talk. You know, before she wrote Little Women, she wrote tales of she wrote crime fiction and erotica. You know,
I saw that
in there. So, that was shocking to me. She wrote soft porn.
Yes.
In fact, I didn't even know that was her genre,
and she was rather angry that Little Women was such a success, and she had to keep churning out sequels.
Can you find that? Is it still available somewhere?
Yes, it is. There's a wonderful the rare book scholars who discovered this wrote a wonderful memoir about this discovery called Old Books, Old Friends, where they talk all about discovering these rather smutty little stories of Louisa May Alcott in the Harvard archive.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Huck Finn was banned originally because it was concluded that Huck would be a bad role model for children.
Yeah.
And then in the civil rights movement, it was later banned because of the prodigious use of the N-word.
Mm. Right.
And then in the 90s, it was again censored or questioned because there was fear that the portrayal of Jim as rather simple-minded and gullible and essentially a pawn in Huck's childhood schemes was a grotesque stereotype of African American.
Mm. Okay, yeah, I can see why that might be, but you know, Mark Twain. I don't know something about Mark Twain. I just. He's like a Midwestern icon, you know?
Well, yeah, he was. I recently bought his autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read that?
All 9 million pages of it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
No, it was given to me as a gift, sitting there on the shelf looking.
I haven't finished it either, but it is really fascinating. And the thing that, one of the things, of course, that's most fascinating about it is that he wrote it with the kind of the restriction that it could not be published until 100 years after his death.
That's right.
And because he wanted to be able to write honestly about the people in his life without offending anybody or hurting anybody. So I thought that was really interesting. And the other thing was that it was so difficult for him to actually do. You know, he was a fairly prodigious writer, but it seemed like this, he had a lot of false starts.
Mm-hmm.
He never really finished it.
Yes. And Huck Finn, as we know, took him 8 years, where it took its companion, it took Tom Sawyer much less time than that.
Huh.
And in the middle between Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, Mark Twain, you know, because he couldn't get going on Huck Finn, managed to crank out two other books. I hope to be that productive someday, but it is, the historical record is very clear that Mark Twain had a very tough time getting Huck Finn together.
Wow.
That's interesting.
And I submit that Mark Twain was coming to grips with being a middle-aged man while he was writing that book. He was very successful. He had a wife and family that loved him. But he had a very hard time with this book that was set in his pre-Civil War childhood in Missouri.
Did he live abroad for a time?
Yes.
Yes, and one of the two books he wrote was about his travels abroad, and the other one was about his time as a riverboat captain when he was in his early 20s.
Right.
He's clearly nostalgic for something. But the world we get in Huck Finn is actually not sentimental at all. It's pretty scary and violent, and it's filled with human bondage and drunk fathers. So I think that what I'm saying in Practical Classics is what Mark Twain is saying in Huck Finn is that Huck and I, Mark Twain, and America have really grown up, and we are in fact better for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've come through some scary times.
Yes, and we've arrived better here, older and wiser on the other side. So it's as much a testament to maturity and aging as it is to nostalgia for childhood.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now you also credit it with being sort of the founding father of a certain genre.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I like to say that the road movie, which is the road movie or the road novel, which is a uniquely American phenomenon because we have a lot of roads and a lot of cars, and you can't do a road movie set in Luxembourg. The country is too small. I feel like that begins with Huck and Jim's trip on the raft down the Mississippi.
Yeah. And you say it's also difficult to imagine the Southern tradition of folk humor without Mark Twain.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to, and Roy Blunt Jr. And Louis Grizzard and the great Southern humorists would say as much, as would Flannery O'Connor if she were still with us, and many of Mark Twain's children and grandchildren. It's a shame that it is incredibly important book, and it is great, and thankfully it is great fun to read as well.
Now, speaking of Flannery O'Connor, did you include any of her works?
I did not. It's funny. The more I did this project, the more people said, "Well, what about this and what about that?" And the best I could do was kind of shrug sheepishly and keep a list.
Another book. Another
do you
book.
Have? Do you have another 50?
Oh, I have hundreds at this point. I mean, the list. The list is the size of like a roll of paper towel. There are several sequels that could be possible, but I think, you know, when I'm in an optimistic frame of mind, I just say that means I have a lifetime of good reading ahead.
Right. Well, what book did you leave out that you feel like maybe was a mistake to have left out?
So, I really had it in my mind that I wanted to include James Baldwin as part of Practical Classics.
Mm.
And when I did, I picked up his second novel, Giovanni's Room, and I enjoyed that very much, and I was trying to figure out where it was going to go in the overall structure of Practical Classics. And then I realized the book I should have included of his was his first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, and by then it was kind of too late, because the section where Go Tell It on the Mountain should have been was already filled up. So I'm sad that I didn't include that. I'm sad that I didn't include Flannery O'Connor. A lot of people ask, why no Charles Dickens? I don't know. I didn't quite know where to start with Charles Dickens.
Right.
I'll have to save that for the imaginary sequel at this point.
Well, one of the things that I enjoyed about this book, and I didn't have it long enough to read the whole thing yet, but I actually do plan to go back and read it, is that a lot of these books I did not read in high school. In fact, I would say very few of them did I actually read in high school. A few of them I have read since, but there's quite a few that I'm not familiar with. And it's a really good introduction to those books.
Mm-hmm.
And your writing style is not, you know, this isn't literary criticism. This is more like motivating someone to actually read the book.
Well, thank you. Thank
yeah.
you. Yeah, I find expertise, at least in myself, very uninteresting. I am much more interested in being a rabid fan or supporter than I am of being a know-it-all. So the business was for this book not to read like Practical Classics, :50 books Kevin knows more about than you do. And that was, I was not interested in that at all. So it was very important to me that the writing style be that of a fellow reader who's just done perhaps a little bit more research than you, but is no smarter than you are. The other thing you said is that the book is intended to be an introduction. It is, yes. It is intended to be an introduction and an invitation to spend some time with some great books. And my hope is that the tone that I've created in Practical Classics gives readers the idea that they actually have more time than they think they do. Because great books, part of what makes them great is they don't go anywhere. You can pick up Practical Classics tomorrow, or you can pick it up 5 years from now. The books I talk about are not going anywhere,
yeah,
and will be waiting for you.
That's right.
If you need them to be.
I know. I think I need to like take a leave of absence from
so.
My life so I can catch up on my reading. I was also one of those, I was a child who read
every opportunity.
By the time I got to high school, what I would do is sit in class with the textbook propped open in front of me and the book I was reading inside the textbook.
Caroline, can you attest to getting calls from teachers?
Well, actually, I was telling Monica, I was an English teacher for some years, and we had a textbook and a curriculum to follow, and we really weren't supposed to deviate from that. And so a lot of these books, my students didn't have an opportunity to read unless they read them on their own.
Yeah.
And but that's been, 20 years ago, 25 years ago since I taught, so I
also had a flashlight in my
yeah, I'm sure you did.
In my room so that after the lights were out I could read under the covers.
No, I did one of your teachers did call in elementary school and she said if there are two minutes or even less between the time the bell's going to ring and Monica picks up a book. she's reading I said, I believe it.
And I still do that. I just, if I have 5 minutes, if I have 10 minutes. And that's the great thing about smartphones. I have my Kindle app on my smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm standing in line, I can actually start reading.
Yeah, that does alleviate the problem that all of us readers have.
Yeah.
When we go on a trip or we go someplace to run errands or we know we're going to be away from home for a while, of the... I could pack one book, but what if I finish that book? And what if I don't like that book? Maybe I should pack five or six. And
I know.
Yep. Wildly impractical that is. I do think that the technology has given us one thing, which is incredibly positive, which is access to more reading material that is actually less in terms of cubic weight than dragging a large load of books around.
Right, and you're not destroying any trees either.
Yes, that as well.
Yeah. No, you're just using electricity or not?
Sort of battery, and then you have to recharge the battery, but yeah.
There's always something.
There's always a cost.
There's always a cost, yeah.
But yeah, it's there's still something, I'd still prefer reading from a physical book. There's, maybe I'm just old-fashioned.
No, there's something about it. Something about it. And same with letters.
I don't know if you are old-fashioned. I think people prefer what they prefer for a number of different reasons. I happen to prefer physical books because I lose things.
Mm.
I'm more comfortable losing a $12 paperback than a $9 reading device. I think the reason I prefer physical books is I like the simple act of shutting the book when I'm done,
mm-hmm.
knowing I'm done, and I just don't feel that sense of sort of finality when you close a file on a reading device.
It's also much easier to browse a physical book than
mm-hmm. yes.
than an electronic
yes.
one.
I'm sure there's some people who are very skilled with their reading devices who can browse better than me. But,
yeah.
I do read. I mean, I read newspapers and magazines and those kind of things on reading devices. But books, I haven't gotten there quite yet.
Well, I do, and I actually probably do at least half of my reading on the Kindle. But I still do like the physical book. And speaking of physical books, why don't we have Kevin read one of his chapters, and so that our listeners can get an idea of really the tone and how he's
mm-hmm.
how he's writing
Good idea.
About these books. So this is Kevin Smokler. He's going to read from Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School.
Oh, before we do that,
okay.
Yeah. we just had A.J. Jacobs on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then he was at Iowa Wesleyan College, which is in the town just east of here, Mount Pleasant, and he was speaking there, so we saw him there, and so we got to meet him in person. And he says, Smokler's book is fascinating, is relevant, and has completely wrecked my schedule for the next several months. After reading his sharp insights on all these classics, I feel inspired to read them again, or for the first time in some cases, in a lot of cases. He was a very interesting
right.
man,
he's great.
Too.
He's a fantastic writer and a good friend, and I was very lucky to have him read and blurb my book.
Yeah. And he's the author of The Year of Living Biblically, and what was his latest one? It was on health, Drop Dead something.
Healthy.
Drop Dead Healthy.
Yeah.
Yep. So
this is, you folks wanted to hear the chapter on To Kill a Mockingbird, correct?
Right.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay. So this is chapter 26. This is called Why To Kill a Mockingbird Makes a Great Father's Day Gift. Harper Lee's original title for To Kill a Mockingbird was Atticus. At the time of its writing, she was an airline reservation agent living in New York City and working with an editor to craft a novel from a series of character sketches and scenes from her childhood in Monroeville, Alabama. Atticus Finch, the widowed lawyer and the father to the book's narrator, Scott Finch, would become one of the most beloved characters in American literature. And his origins can be loosely traced to the author's own father, A.C. Lee, also a respected lawyer, civil rights advocate, and one of the most beloved citizens of Monroeville. Is Scout Finch Harper Lee? Is Atticus Finch her dad? Questions of how much Mockingbird is autobiography have hung around like heavy summer air since the book's publication in 1960. Finch was, in fact, the maiden name of Harper Lee's mother. But Harper Lee grew up with both parents, not a widowed father, and with three siblings instead of one, like Scout Finch. And surprisingly, by many accounts, her dad, A.C. Lee, was significantly more accepting of his community's laws of segregation than his heroic avatar, Atticus Finch. Harper Lee did not care for these inquiries into her own childhood and stopped granting interviews in 1964. And despite her being a whole lot like Scout Finch, a willful youngest child, precocious, and a tomboy, the 2010 documentary, Hey Boo, Harper Lee and To Kill a Mockingbird, makes the strong case that Harper Lee, the grown-up, is a lot more like Boo Radley, Scout Finch's shadowy neighbor. That Lee has not written another novel nor spoken publicly about Mockingbird in a half-century is very Boo Radley. Radley's desire in Depression-era Maycomb, Alabama, would convict his creator of a crime new to the America of the 21st century, the desire to be invisible and to be left alone. Harper Lee hasn't told us much about what we are supposed to get out of To Kill a Mockingbird, so we're kind of left to fill in the blanks on our own. It is at once a novel about racism, the American South, growing up, the criminal justice system, family, a small-town girlhood, and moral conviction in the sneering face of intolerance. It may be too easy to explain its success, a Pulitzer Prize, an Oscar-winning film adaptation, a half-century in print, and still the most assigned book in American high schools this way. But To Kill a Mockingbird may be that rare novel with something for everyone. I never quite understood then why we often abandon it to the back country of childhood, as if we outgrow the book when we get older to Atticus's age and further from Scout. That leaves a whole trove of the book's riches wilting in the old tree hole. Mockingbird is told in flashback from the point of view of a child in the voice of a grown-up. Of course we can imagine a 17-year-old Scout saying or hearing the book's most famous line, "Hey, Boo," or "Miss Jean Louise, stand up, your father's passing." But a second grader can't follow up "Hey, Boo" 10 pages later with, "I never saw Boo Radley again," unless many years have passed between the story and the adult Scout's telling of it. Harper Lee was in fact about Scout Finch's age when her father gave her a typewriter and encouraged her writing. She was in her early 30s during the difficult 2 years that she wrestled Atticus into To Kill a Mockingbird. She was also far from home, intimidated, and scared. Her mother had passed away nearly a decade before, and we know Harper Lee had planted a lot of nostalgia and tributes throughout the novel to siblings, to a faraway hometown, at a time several decades ago. But filling the center row of To Kill a Mockingbird seems to be a thanks to the author's still-living parent, who had believed in her talent and dreams, especially at the time in her life when she needed that faith so much. Looked at this way, To Kill a Mockingbird is as much a book about parenthood as it is about childhood, a tribute to a father who confronted, not flawlessly but admirably, the most difficult challenge of having children, that a parent's decisions affect the life of a developing person, and that children are learning not just from the decisions you make, but from the reasons you had in making them. That's that kind of heroism we've kind of brushed over in our 50-year canonization of Atticus Finch. In 2003, the American Film Institute named the character the greatest hero in American film. The role would be the signature of Gregory Peck. Brock Peters, the actor who played Tom Robinson, would deliver the eulogy at Gregory Peck's funeral. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and lawyer-novelist Scott Turow have both credited Atticus Finch with bringing nobility and honor to the American legal profession. But Atticus Finch is no knight in a white suit. The genius of Harper Lee's invention was to house his heroism in fatherhood as much as lawyering. We are a full 80 pages into To Kill a Mockingbird before there is even mention of Tom Robinson. And the novel is half over before his trial commences. To Kill a Mockingbird also begins and ends with Boo Radley, a plot thread that allows Atticus to play the supporting role of protective father and single parent who knows when to give his children room to fail, room to learn, and to grow into their own people. His final line to Boo Radley, "Thank you for my children, Arthur," contains both gratitude and sadness. Gratitude that his family is safe despite living in a world of cruelty and misunderstanding, and sad recognition that he cannot protect Scout and Jem forever. One day Atticus Finch's greatest act as a parent will be admitting that he has raised his children as best he can, and then letting them go. The adult Scout Finch has written this story, not just to show what a noble thing Atticus Finch did as Tom Robinson's lawyer, but also to show how well she turned out thanks to who he was as her dad. Mm-hmm. Mockingbird captures Atticus's second chapter of parenthood. The first might have taken place when his wife was still alive. The third is wherever Scout Finch is now as an adult. In the middle, we have To Kill a Mockingbird, and we have a parent who may be the best shot in the county, but is also too old to play football with his son, and too creaky to get into a fist fight with Bob Ewell. Atticus Finch's power comes not from feats of physicality, but from feats of reason, from a steady moral view of a world that makes little sense to his children, even though they've never known another one. Telling his children that courage isn't a man with a gun in his hand, and that you never really know a man until you walk a mile in his shoes, is Atticus Finch's great lesson. It is a lesson not so much of fortitude, but of maturity. It is easy to call an attorney on a moral crusade a hero. It is much harder to see the heroism of Atticus Finch as a widower. He is not poor or ignorant like Bob Ewell, nor is he ostracized or absent like Boo Radley's father. But he understands, as no other character does in this book, the bargain you make with the universe when you become a parent. That it provides you hundreds of opportunities, mostly in the name of fear and cowardice, to say to your children, "Do as I say, not as I do." To do the easy thing instead of the right thing. It's as if Atticus says, as Atticus says, it's a sin to kill a mockingbird because mockingbirds don't do one thing but sing their hearts out and make everybody feel good, he means it for everyone, even those who are single parents, sole providers, tired, worn-down people with children who depends on them for a future that makes sense. It's a sin not just to kill a mockingbird, but to kill innocent, to take advantage of another's goodwill, to be a bully, to do what is right for you, and to speed past how wrong it might be for someone else. It's why I like to remind parents I know, particularly fathers, of To Kill a Mockingbird. I like to imagine Harper Lee on those long days and nights in that little room in New York City, thousands of miles from her home in Alabama, and neck deep in the largest, most difficult writing project of her life. I like to imagine her looking down at the typewriter, remembering the one her father gave her as a child as an act of trust and of pride. And I imagine her saying, when To Kill a Mockingbird was done, "Look at what you made me into. Look at what I wrote. Thank you for showing me who I could be. You had to make hard decisions, and I was watching."
Oh, that's great. That's yeah.
That was Kevin Smokler reading from his book Practical Classics, and you're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU-FM. One of the things I really like about this book is that you give background of the writer and what was going on in their life when they were writing the book, which, you can look at a book just on its own, but putting it in context, I think, adds a lot to your understanding.
I feel the same. It was really important to me that, as fond of we all are of great books, that we not view them as sort of delivered from heaven by angels,
right?
And not having any context, and not viewing the people who wrote them as human beings. I think if we do that, it's too hard to. We don't give ourselves permission not to like a book. We don't give ourselves permission to see it critically. It makes books into sort of monuments you're supposed to kneel before,
mm-hmm.
and it makes them static. I think if you imagine this book, the creation of a human being just like you, it means the book is alive. And that's the reading world I want to live in.
Well, speaking of putting things in context and looking at the author, what have you got to say about William Shakespeare?
It's funny. I the essay in Practical Classics is just called "Hello, I'm William Shakespeare," which is supposed to be a "Hello, I'm Johnny Cash" joke. But what I wrote one essay sort of on the totality of William Shakespeare's work, and the essay is basically a guide to how to wade into the ocean that is William Shakespeare. I think, you know, when people are sort of force-fed Shakespeare in high school, and because Shakespeare is now synonymous with genius, we're sort of not given permission to have a critical attitude about Shakespeare. Now, that did not stop obnoxious 15-year-old Kevin from having a critical attitude about Shakespeare. And as I say in Practical Classics, I was the kid who said famously Shakespeare was trite, and that has haunted me ever since. I spoke at my high school's writing awards ceremony a few months ago, and I was introduced as Kevin Smokler, graduate of 1991. Who once said Shakespeare was trite?
they remembered that.
Yes. and then to wipe away that historical record, at my own graduation, I recited the St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry V. But I think, you know, I think it's very hard to look at how much Shakespeare is a part of our language as English speakers and our literary tradition, and to say, well, you know, because I got stuck with him, you know, in the 10th grade, never again. I think it will take me a bit of time to warm up to Shakespeare, because I still have that, you know, knee-jerk reaction to him, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to spending a little time with him.
Well, I have had the privilege of seeing a couple of performances of Shakespeare that were really, really excellent by actors from the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, one of them was Othello, which I saw in Iowa City at Hancher some years ago. I also have seen Macbeth at the Shakespeare Globe Theater in London.
Neat.
Yeah, and that, when you see Shakespeare performed by a really, really talented acting troupe like that, it gives you a whole nother perspective, because you know, we struggle with the language when we're reading it, or even when you're watching kind of a run-of-the-mill performance, you're trying to figure out what does this mean? What is it really saying? Because it is, you know, it's not the way we speak anymore, although, as you point out, a lot of the way we speak comes directly from there. You talk about phrases he invented in the blink of an eye, foregone conclusion, heart of gold. Every Shakespeare play you go to, you'll hear a phrase and you're like, wow, we still say that all the time. But the overall structure of the language, of course, is different. The syntax is different and can be challenging to understand. But when you're watching a really, really good performance, it's like that you no longer have to engage the intellect to understand. The actors are conveying it so clearly.
Oh, absolutely. I think we're both implying that was also how Shakespeare was originally supposed to be consumed. Shakespeare was not read originally; it was performed, and it was popular entertainment. It was the thing you did. It was the thing you did in the afternoon when your shift at the blacksmith finished, and you walked over. You know, you walked across London and took in a play. And let us not remember, there was no sense of the audience being quiet during the play back then. You know, people didn't sit quietly and listen to the play. They were loud. They threw things at the actors. They complained when they didn't like what they heard. And the bottom floor of the Globe Theater didn't have bathrooms. So people would often sneak out at intermission and relieve themselves, or they would do so right there on the floor. So
gross.
Yes, it was not a quaint, civilized thing to do, to see Shakespeare back in Shakespeare's time. Uh-huh. And I think so. What I argue in the essay for this, for the Shakespeare essay in Practical Classics, as I say, if you want to reintroduce yourself to Shakespeare, read a plot summary, find a local production, go to that production. I say read the plot summary so you know what you're getting into and you don't spend the first 30 minutes trying to keep the story straight. And then make sure you have dinner or lunch or whatever is the next meal afterwards. Preferably make it unhealthy. and make sure to include dessert. Because that's what people did in Shakespeare's. Now, it might have been a leg of mutton back then, but that's pretty much what people did.
And you're right, it was pop culture. So nowadays, you know, I've heard people sort of like look down their nose at pop culture, but Shakespeare was the pop culture of his time.
Absolutely. One of the things I really wanted to get across in Practical Classics is this whole divide between what's great literature and what's pop literature is really nothing more than our own insecurities on display. Mm. Am I reading great books is really a way of saying, am I an intelligent person? Well, if you have to ask, you probably are. You're probably just insecure about it. And I trust people to determine what kind of books work for them and don't. What I was intending to do here in Practical Classics was just suggest some books that probably we've all heard of, but we may have ignored, overlooked, or not remembered from back in the day because some person in authority insisted this was a great book. I don't think they were wrong in insisting that, but that sort of puts it in the context of you, the reader, only being allowed to have one opinion on it.
And also that you probably won't really enjoy it. You're not reading it for enjoyment. You're reading it for education.
Yes, that there's something suspect about enjoyment.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Now, are there any, like, current pop books, popular books that you think will someday make, you know, that 50 years from now would make this list?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's at least a dozen or two living writers who are producing books that will one day be classics. Most of the work of John Updike, most of the work of Toni Morrison, most of the work of Margaret Atwood, definitely books like The Hours by Michael Cunningham and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, and probably, you know, A Visit to the Goon Squad, but from Jennifer Egan, and tons. We have more good writers producing good books today than we know what to do with. We just need to let time pass and see which ones survive.
And some of them are actually best-selling books.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's almost no connection between how much a book sells and how well it is regarded 50, 100 years later. Henry James's Daisy Miller was a resounding best-selling success, like a crazy, out-of-the-park best-selling success, and Moby Dick was a flop. Moby Dick cast Harold Melville into depression for the rest of his life because nobody wanted to buy that book.
Wow.
The Great Gatsby was a flop.
Wow.
They've just come out with a new movie of that, by the way.
Yes, we have a brand new movie of that coming out in just a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Now, did you include Hemingway?
I did not. I wanted to, and I flirted with a couple of his books. I had a hard time figuring out. I felt like Hemingway's version of masculinity was a little stuck in 50, 75 years ago. And I didn't quite know how I was going to bring that forth into the present day.
Well, I recently read A Movable Feast, mm-hmm. and I think that's the title, but the one where he's writing about his early years in Paris and with his first wife. And there's a line in there that's just kind of one of my favorite lines ever, and it when he's talking about his first wife, Hadley Hemingway, mm-hmm. and whom he, you know, cheated on and left and ran off and married her best friend. And,
right.
And he says, and writing, looking back on that from, you know, decades later, he says, I wish I had died before I'd loved anyone but her.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Hey, good name.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's very, very touching. But, yeah, you know, that time period of writers, so you did represent that kind of that group of writers by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yes.
And any others? Did you pick any others up from that Paris in the 20s?
No. I think F. Scott Fitzgerald was really the one from that period. And then a generation later, of course, we had Harper Lee and Sylvia Plath, both of whom I refer to. And I, you know, I, I haven't quite taken a look at all 50 of the books that I included in Practical Classics to see how they shook out, you know, which which authors from which periods I focused on. And I think that was largely the product of having only 10 months to do it in.
Right, right.
But I do feel comfortable that there are enough books that are recognizable here as often assigned in high school books. And if someone picks up Practical Classics and has heard of none of the books in here, I probably can't help them. And if they've already read all 50 of them and feel totally and feel committed to their expertise on all 50 of them, I probably can't help them either. It's the people in the middle who have read some of them and are curious.
That would be me, yes. Definitely.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yep. Well, Kevin, what are you working on now?
So there is thoughts of a sequel of some kind to Practical Classics, and maybe different versions on the same theme. I'm kind of curious about doing a book about kids and young adult books that the parents should reread.
Ah.
So I'm thinking about that, and then I've got a larger project that's been bubbling in my mind for a long time about pop. Popular music and the history of popular music in this country, and I'm really kind of curious to get to that too.
What angle are you taking on that?
I'm really I'm 39 years old, and I'm really kind of fascinated what has happened to popular music in the last two or three decades. How music went from being this thing that was largely consumed over a radio or a device to a thing that was largely to a thing that was also consumed in enormous concert venues, to later a thing that was consumed on television, to later a thing that you carried around with you and is now represented by a single digital file. The fact that all of those changes happened in 30 years, it just makes your head spin, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
That's kind of fascinated as to what that period of time has meant for people who are not musicians, not music industry professionals, but people who simply love music, and what it means to be a music fan with all of those changes.
Interesting. So Practical Classics was published quite recently, is that true?
At the end of February.
End of February. And you've been doing quite a bit of... You've got a book tour coming up, right?
I've got several more dates. I did an East Coast swing last month.
Okay.
And I've got a couple more dates on the East Coast coming up, and then my publisher and I are thinking about how to give this book another go around when the school year begins, because it has a very clear academic angle as well.
That is true. And I saw on your website, which is kevinsmokler.com, about your impromptu invitation to be on NPR. I can't remember the show, but
Talk of the Nation.
So what happened there?
I was headed. It was a Thursday morning, and I was headed to the gym, and the phone rang, and it was a producer from Talk of the Nation who said, "We'd like to have you on the show. Can you get to?" She gave me an address and said, "Can you get to this place, which is a radio studio, by 11 o'clock?" I didn't really go to the gym. I just showered and changed my clothes and drove across town and parked myself at a coffee shop across the street from the studio with a notebook and tried to make sense of what I was going to say for 15 minutes on Talk of the Nation.
Wow.
The context the producer gave it to me in was that the other two stories on that hour of Talk of the Nation were about political unrest in Algeria and the rape trial in India.
Oh, boy.
And so I was going to be the digestif at the end of the heavy meal.
Okay.
And I was like, I'm more than happy to do that. I just appreciate being asked, and Practical Classics is nothing if not light and fun. So I'm more than happy to serve that role.
Now, why was it so last minute?
Oh, I think that's just the way public radio and media work. This is my best understanding. I think they probably had a cancellation, or someone was stuck in traffic. I don't think it was any more complicated than that.
But you were in the right place at the right time.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the producer had read an essay I had written about, had read the Catcher in the Rye essay from Practical Classics.
Now, have you had, you know, as you're doing these events, have you had some unusual questions come up?
Yes, yes. The most interesting question I've had was actually an interview I did for the Atlantic Wire. And then that question has subsequently come up at a couple of other events. And the question is do these books, do the books you feature in Practical Classics still mean something if you first read them as an adult? In other words, if you don't have kind of the false start of reading them as a teenager, do you need that? Do you need reading them as a teenager to see them anew as a grown-up? God, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. As best I can come up with is reading them as teenagers gives us, it's basically like doing warm-up exercises before you do exercises for real. Like you need the warm-up to read at your best potential when you're a grown-up. However, the danger is that you will only hold on to the bad memories you have of being a 14-year-old trying to make sense of Shakespeare or Edith Wharton or Dante or something like that. And you'll throw the baby out with the bathwater and simply say to yourself, well, you know, Dante's no fun. I'm never going to go back to that again because I remember being 14 and trying. So I have every faith that the educators in this country are doing their damnedest to make these books not just nutritious but fun as well. And I think that's vitally important in order to appreciate them as an adult.
I do, too, to preserve our culture.
Yes, yes. Strangely enough, I get asked all the time, because I've written this book and I've been public speaking for a long time about the future of books in this country, I get asked all the time, Kevin, how can we make people take books more seriously? And I say, no, we need people to take books far less seriously.
Yes.
We need people to see books as enjoyable as television or the movies or going to concerts or all of the other things people can do with their spare time.
Right.
If we insist that books are broccoli, well, people will eat them about as often as they eat broccoli.
Good point. Yes.
Well, Kevin, we are out of time, and thank you so much for joining us today on Writers' Voices, and we look forward.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I look forward to finishing Practical Classics.
Yes.
And of course, it's available wherever books are sold.
Yes.
And let us know when your next book comes out.
I absolutely will, and I look forward to tuning into more of your shows. You guys run a great program.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I have to. There's one section here I don't know if he was a philosopher, what, Camus?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so when I had a radio show on KMCD back in the 70s here in town, I had a theme song, and my theme song came from his quote, "Don't walk ahead, I might not follow. Don't walk behind, I might not lead."
What a great quote.
Just walk beside me, share my... And I added this. Just walk beside me, share my friendship, and we will fill each other's needs.
Oh, I must look that up.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.